Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is documentary filmmaker Sam Pollard. Pollard has been an important chronicler of the Black experience in America as a documentary film producer and director and film editor. His output includes the Emmy Award-winning work on Eyes on the Prize, Spike Lee Presents Mike Tyson, an Oscar-nominated documentary Four Little Girls about the 1963 Birmingham church bombing, and the Peabody Award-winning When the Levees Broke about Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans. In addition to that work, some of which were collaborating with Spike Lee, he also edited Lee's feature films between 1990 and 2000. Currently, he is the director of the feature documentary MLK FBI, currently in theaters and on demand, about recently declassified FBI documents about the agency's surveillance of the civil rights leader. His 1992 film, Going Back to T-Town, which documented the history of Tulsa's Greenwood District, will be reshown on PBS's American Experience next Monday, February 8th. The film, which offers an oral history of Tulsa's Black Wall Street, features some of Tulsa's most prominent Black citizens telling the story of the building of the community, the destruction during the race massacre, and its rebuilding, only to again decline with desegregation and destruction through urban renewal and the construction of the interstate. Here's a clip with Mabel Little describing her reaction to the race massacre.
I never had any feeling. It was such a shock until, I don't know, that the Lord just strengthened me. But my husband was, he was so tender. He just broke down. He said, baby, we've lost everything we had. I said, but we have each other, honey. I never shed a tear with him. In fact, I never have been angry. I felt sorry for the people that treated our folks like that.
The Red Cross recorded more than 300 people had been killed. Newspapers listed almost 100 deaths, but city officials put the death toll at 36. More than 35 blocks of Black Tulsa was burned to the ground. Over 4,000 people were left homeless. Still, most of the people of Greenwood refused to leave.
That's a clip from Going Back to T-Town, which was produced by my guest today, documentary filmmaker Sam Pollard. The film will be shown on PBS's American Experience next Monday evening, and he's my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Sam Pollard, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure, Rich. Thanks for having me.
Your 1992 film, Going Back to T-Town, will be shown on American Experience. It's a beautiful film, and for Tulsans, it's wonderful to see so many people that are no longer with us on this film telling the story of Greenwood, and a much larger story of Greenwood, of the resilience of the community to survive a race massacre, and just the heart of the community. Tell me about making that film. What was the inspiration for making the film?
Well, quite honestly, it was a Tulsa native, a woman named Carmen Field, who was from Tulsa, lived in Boston, and she reached out to me and my partner, Joyce Vaughn, and said, there's a wonderful group of ladies in Tulsa who get together once a week and talk about the old days living in Greenwood, and maybe we should make a film about them. So we went out there and visited these ladies who Carmen Fields knew. One of the ladies was her own mother. And as we sort of talked to these ladies and started to explore the history of the community, we decided it should be a bigger film, much more than just about these ladies, but about the Black community in Tulsa and what they struggled with after the Tulsa race massacre in 1921 and how they sort of came back as a community where they were sort of in a segregated community and how they were self-empowered. And how the community changed when integration came along. So it became a much bigger sort of palette to work on. And the other thing that's interesting, too, is that Carmen's brother, his name is Ernie Fields.
Yeah, Ernie Fields Jr., right.
Yeah, Ernie Fields Jr. Her father, Ernie Fields, had been one of those band leaders from the 30s, you know, had one of those really interesting bands. So some of the music in the film is used is Ernie Fields' music, Ernie Fields Sr.'s music. So we went back to Tulsa. And we were very fortunate, because Carmen knew most of these people, to be introduced to a lot of people that lived in the community during the race massacre and lived in the community after the race riot. And how the city, the community, has kind of found its legging. It found itself again after that and been able to sort of rebuild itself. And it became, you know, as I said, a much bigger story. And then these were wonderful people in UA. Most of them have passed away. But I rewatched the film recently, and I forgot how compelling and engaging these interviews were.
When you were making the film, were you trying to tell a specific story about Greenwood, or was it a larger story of all sorts of Black Main Streets? Because that story was, part of the story was specific to Tulsa and Greenwood, but it was also a large, it seems to me the film is a larger story of Black Main Streets through the 20th century.
Well, you know, at the time, we just really focused on Tulsa, understanding full well that there were many other Black Main Streets around the country, you know, in Atlanta and Chicago and Harlem and Los Angeles. They all had their very self-contained Black communities. But this one was really specifically focusing on Tulsa. And we had also spoken to the historian John O. Franklin, whose father had been a lawyer for those people who had lost their homes after the race riots, you know, and Buck Franklin. So it sort of was more about Greenwood and Tulsa. And, you know, and we traveled around Tulsa. We drove to Oklahoma to do research. We went to the all-Black community in Boley, Oklahoma, and met some people there. So it was really about the community in Tulsa and in Greenwood.
Obviously, the film is being shown again because of the centennial commemoration of the race massacre. And that story is told in full. And I think it's even more powerful hearing these voices who survive those few nights and the years later. I think I was one of the most compelling parts was hearing John Hope Franklin, who was still a boy. He's watching his father fight to rebuild the community. And there's a wonderful quote where he's describing the following winter, where as far as you could see as you look through the Greenwood District in North Tulsa, nothing but tents and shacks.
That's right. Yeah. That's exactly right. You know, and it was fascinating to me is that, you know, we did this film almost, what is it, 27 years ago, 28 years ago. And now there's like four or five films being made about Tulsa as it reaches its 100th anniversary. It's amazing to me.
So, you know, there's always been the history of America through white eyes and other people's eyes. Was this a story you knew very well throughout your life, Sam?
No. I had known a little bit about it, but then after I met Carmen and talked with her and I went and did some book, it was a book, I don't remember the title, but it was about Tulsa and the race riot, race massacre, which I had read. There's a couple other books.
Probably Death in the Promised Land, which was one of the first books.
That was the one.
Yes, and that wasn't written until like, you know, late 70s, early 80s.
Yeah, that's the one I read. And then we went to Raleigh Durham and spent a couple of days with John Hope Franklin, and he gave us some more backstory. So it really became a story that I really dug into. I had just come off of working on Eyes on the Prize. So I was in this notion that, you know, as an African-American film director, I wanted to always dig into our stories about our history, which I always makes people understand that it's American history, too. So, you know, it was a story that I didn't know a lot about at the time, but as I did the research, I got to know more and more about it.
Yeah, I was wondering because, you know, for most white Oklahomans, this was a story that was never talked about, never spoken about until probably the mid-'80s, early 90s, about the time you're making your film.
Right. So, and the question is does this generation, the young generation of African Americans, not really know the story about Tulsa now? From your experience, do they know the story?
I think they do. I think certainly in this part of the country they do. Now, whether the larger African-American community in America know it, I think they do, but it's hard to say.
Right.
I'm no longer anywhere near that generation.
Right. Neither am I.
Well,
But it was one of these stories that as I got into it, as we made the film, as we went down there to Tulsa, and we interviewed all these people, it was just, what was fascinating to me was just how really resilient the community was after and how they really came back with their own stores, their own funeral parlors, their own restaurants, their own cleaners and stuff. And really, that's the part of the story that when I rewatched it, I forgot that really was a very strong part of the story, too.
I'd like to play a little clip. It's from the very end of the documentary.
Sure.
And it reflects and it features Mabel Little, Dr. Franklin, and a number of the oral histories that you collect and tell during the course of the documentary, where they're talking about the resilience of the community. they're not, and what's interesting is there's sort of this, you know, done in the early 90s, you know, Greenwood was pretty moribund at that particular point, and still is nowhere near was during its heyday. But what was interesting was there's this sense of wistfulness of looking at segregation and seeing it, recognizing the evil of it, but also sort of there was a wistfulness about it that's apparent in this clip.
Right.
Is that something you sensed as you were talking with a lot of the people that were part of the film?
Yeah, you know, because what's really fascinating about this history in our country is even though, you know, we understand the horrors, you know, segregation and how we African-Americans are treated as second-class citizens, on the other side of the spectrum, there's a sense of even though we were forced into this sort of segregated society, we were able to flourish and have our own sort of self-contained, prosperous community to what level we could. We had our own doctors and lawyers within the community. And so the challenge always is to kind of look at how when segregation was abolished and many people left the community and integrated in other communities, the impact it had on these self-contained communities. I mean, it's sort of like, you know, a sadness there. You know, we're glad that we're able to now integrate, but there's a sadness, too, that the communities that have been self-contained and strong no longer exist. I mean, it's very complicated in a way.
Well, let's hear that clip. This is from Going Back to T-Town, Sam Pollard's 1992 film on Tulsa's Greenwood District made with Carmen Fields, which will be shown on PBS's American Experience Monday, February 8th.
We had good role models, good people who were training and teaching us in our community.
I wish some of these children could experience what we experienced, this thing of living together and depending on each other and the brotherhood that we had.
They'd always tell us that the opportunities were going to come down the road. Don't worry about them because they would show up.
There was a sense of self-respect and self-esteem and the feeling that our color didn't have anything to do with our not being as good as anyone else.
Segregation made black folk take care of themselves, be independent, have their own business, see, train their children, build their colleges, build their schools, build their homes. Integration separated them.
I don't think racial segregation is a good thing from the American experience. So in that sense, no, we're not better off. But the quality of our lives, in many respects, was better in the days of segregation. And the challenge today is to make it as good or better.
That was a clip from Going Back to T-Town, Sam Pollard's 1992 film on Tulsa's Greenwood District, which will be shown on PBS, American Experience. He's my guest today, documentary filmmaker, producer, director, and editor. His latest film, MLK FBI, is currently showing in theaters and streaming services. Mr. Pollard, if we can talk about your latest film, MLK FBI, a big source of the film is newly declassified documents from the FBI of their surveillance of Martin Luther King. Was that the starting point for this film, or was it the work that has gone on publicizing those documents that became the heart of the film?
The starting point of the film for us, for myself and my producer, Bernadine, was a book written by the historian David Garrow about MLK, Martin Luther King, and how he was surveilled on a constant basis from 63 up to his assassination by J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI. And after we both read that book, we thought this would be a film. So then Ben went into, you know, Freedom of Information Act to find all these transcripts from the FBI's recordings of Dr. King. We reached out to David Garrow. We optioned his book. We ended up flying to Pittsburgh, where he lives. We took a camera crew to his house, and we spent 4 hours with him documenting, shooting him, talking about the genesis of the book, what he learned in his research, you know, about the complexity of the FBI and Hoover, you know, surveilling King, first initially thinking that he was a communist, he was connected to the Communist Party because of his relationship with a gentleman named Stanley Levinson. And then learning that they were wiretapping him, that he was having these other relationships with other women than his wife, Coretta Scott King, and they realized that they could use that, hopefully, to discredit and destroyed Dr. King's reputation with his wife and with the black community, since he was, after the March on Washington, considered the moral leader of the civil rights movement.
Yeah. The film goes into great detail into the depths of the FBI surveillance. What's interesting, though, is all you have are the accounts of the surveillance, not tapes, not transcripts of. I mean, it's basically FBI agents recounting of what they heard.
Yeah, because as you know, the actual tapes will not be released until 2027, and then if they're released, the question I keep asking myself is: will they be edited according to the way the FBI wanted to represent Dr. King? Or will they be released unedited, which to me might be a gold mine, because instead of just thinking about the stuff where King was involved with other women, there may be on those tapes Dr. King's conversations with people like Andy Young and Ralph Abernathy and Fred Shuttlesworth about the strategy they were going to undertake when they went to cities like Birmingham and Albany, Georgia, and Selma, Alabama.
Now, how do you tell a story about this, which is essentially documents?
Well, you first hire yourself a great archival producer who can find all the archival material that relates to Dr. King, the civil rights movement in the 50s and 60s, and the FBI from their genesis in the early 1900s, I mean in the 19-teens, up through the 67, 68. And we were very fortunate that we had a wonderful archival producer named Brian Becker, who did a great job in unearthing lots of this material. The other thing you need to do is then you need to be able to find the people who can talk about these periods in Dr. King. So we had David Garrow on as a historian doing audio. We also brought in two wonderful historians, a woman named Beverly Gage, who could talk about the evolution of the FBI and J. Edgar Hoover's role as the director for over 40 years of the FBI. And we had a woman named Donna Lurch, another historian, who could talk about the FBI and their organization and when they created COINTELPRO, the counterintelligence program, to infiltrate and surveil not only Dr. King and the SCLC, but organizations like the Nation of Islam, the Black Panther Party, individuals like Elijah Muhammad, Malcolm X, Angela Davis, Huey P. Newton, Bobby Seale, Aldrich Cleaver, and others.
Yeah, anybody who was involved in counterculture in the late 1960s, they were infiltrating the organization. They were objectionable part of that, beyond just surveilling them, is that they were actually, in many cases, acting as a provocateur in urging.
Exactly.
Yes.
That's exactly why they were doing. They wanted to really push these organizations to do something that they could really then go in there and take them down. Absolutely. That's a great way to say it. Sure.
And in the case of all of those movements, it really began with the surveillance of Dr. King that sort of
moved
that toward the FBI, towards that period.
Because look, what's fascinating is that they saw Dr. King as a radical. I mean, here's a nonviolent civil rights activist who was considered by J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI as the most dangerous Negro in America at the time, you know. And they saw him as this Black Messiah who is going to have the people raise up, the black community raise up against their notion of American democracy. It's a fascinating story.
We were talking about your archival producer. One of the things I found really amazing about the film was all of this archival material from the first March on Washington. And what was, you know, we're used to seeing this in a very grainy early film videotape format. And what I was amazed at was, wow, look at this amazing footage that is so, I assume this was all digitized and cleaned up, but what's amazing is seeing the March on Washington through new eyes.
You know, I got to really take my hat off to the archival producer, because I too have never seen that footage look so pristine. I mean, I've seen that March on Washington footage many times, and I never saw that quality like that. I mean, he must have really gone all out to find an archival house that would provide such a great high definition quality. It was fantastic. And, you know, in some ways, Rich, it spoiled me now. So every time I do an archival film from this point on, I want to have the best quality possible.
The other interesting thing is you give us a sense of how the FBI was regarded in those days. And what's interesting is the huge, and this is a really fascinating part of the film, is the huge propaganda effort the FBI made through Hollywood films, through television programs, from radio programs, through magazines that projected this image of the FBI, squeaky clean, law and order, following the Constitution in every way. And, you know, it was like, you know, your police procedurals in the 2000 and 2010s, you know, the FBI could do no wrong. And it was put out there all the time.
Well, you know, it's, you know, one piece of footage that's really fascinating to watch is those little boys, those young boys around J. Edgar Hoover, talking about wanting to be FBI agents and stuff. And it's like fascinating footage to watch. Mr. Hoover. I mean, I thought that was like, wow. Talk about being able to create such wonderful propaganda. But, you know, in 1964, Rich, I was 14 years old. And I, even as a young African-American boy growing up in Harlem, I thought the FBI was fantastic. I used to watch every Sunday night that show. You remember that show, the FBI?
Yes, Ephraim's Jr. Yes, Ephraim's Zimbalist
Jr. I watched it every Sunday. You know, I thought it was fantastic, that show.
And I love the way you get the sense of how, I think there was one line where it says, you know, half of Americans believed the FBI's version of who Martin Luther King was. About 20% of the people supported Martin Luther King, and another 30%, they had no opinion or weren't really paying close attention. And I was really struck by, there was a man on the street interview, and it was, you know, a white Southerner, obviously. And he was like, well, listen to what Mr. Hoover says.
Well, you know, that's what, you know, and you forget that. You forget that Dr. King wasn't so revered back in the 60s. And it was even more reviled when he came out against Vietnam in 67. So, you know, when you watch his film, you say, oh, my God, he wasn't so loved. You know, I mean, if more people thought J. Edgar Hoover was popular than Dr. King, that tells you something about where America's head was in the early 60s.
You also had James Comey as a contributor. What did he add to the films?
You know, it's, to me, it was like when our producer, Ben, reached out and said we should reach out to Comey, my first reaction was, do you think he'll do it? And I said, nah. And Ben said, yes, I think he will. He did. What I think he brought to it was his feeling, as you heard him say in the film, that this was one of the darkest chapters in the history of the FBI. And he kept a copy of that letter that they had sent to Dr. King's wife about he should kill himself. So as he said, I don't know if he kept this in the film, but he said that every time they got a new group of recruits, FBI recruits, they would make sure they read that letter just to understand that this was not the FBI that it was. But the FBI today was not the FBI that was happening during that period in the 60s.
If you would explain, so, if you explain that letter for those who have not seen the film.
Sure. By 1964, after Dr. King, what was as he won the Nobel Peace Prize, and he was really being revered all over the world, J. Edgar Hoover and his close associate, William Sullivan, they created a letter. William Sullivan created a letter basically saying Dr. King, supposed to be the voice of a black person. We know who you are. We know what you've done. You're a horrible person. And you have 3 days and you know what you should do. Intimating that he should probably kill himself. Then they sent that letter plus a tape that they probably doctored of Dr. King in a relationship with another woman to the SCLC, and then it got to Coretta Scott King, his wife. Mm. And the idea behind this letter, you know, which is absolutely illegal, and this tape was to really see how they could really destroy King's reputation, not only with his wife now, but with the members of his organization, and was hoping that the press would take it, grab onto it, and publish it. Now, what was interesting is that back in the 60s, the press, not like today, didn't dig into people's personal lives, you know, so they never really took it and used it to any degree.
What's also interesting is watching the press accounts with Dr. King from the hindsight of 2020 and 2021, and watching what was, for the most part, a completely white press question Dr. King in ways in which it's just so cringeworthy. It is coming from a place of such utter white supremacy that it's really hard to watch the press question. You know, there's a Meet the Press segment where
I remember it.
Yeah. Tell us about including those clips.
we include those clips from Meet the Press and the other piece from that woman who asked Dr. King, don't you think the peaceful protests are causing the violence in the city? Now, we include those clips. We did that editing that part of the film probably in May or June. Now, who knew that Trump, when he would ride on the stump, you know, he would say actually the same things. Don't you think these Black Lives protests are leading to the rise in the streets? Don't you think that if you like socialist Democrats, they will destroy our communities? Like much like how people thought about communists in the 60s. So what's really fascinating to me about this film is how, you know, it resonates so well with what was happening in America today. And in some ways, it's shocking that we're still repeating the same history.
My guest today is Sam Pollard, a documentary filmmaker, producer, director, and editor. His latest film is MLK FBI, which is currently showing in theaters and streaming services. And his 1992 film, made with Carmen Fields, going back to T-Town, about Tulsa's Greenwood District, will be shown on PBS's American Experience Monday, February 8th. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, one thing that's been really amazing about your work over the last 10 years, you've been making films after film after film of really interesting stories about Black history. And I know you've already have two projects. What are you working on these days?
Well, I'm finishing up a documentary about the great tennis player Arthur Ashe that I'm co-directing. And I'm also having a documentary that will premiere next year on American Masters about the renowned percussionist, composer, and activist, jazz musician Max Roach. He was one of the founders of what's called the period of bebop with Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie and Thelonious Monk. And in the 50s, he put together a great quintet with the late Clifford Brown and Sonny Rollins. But by early 60s, he became very politically active, and one of his greatest albums is something called The Freedom Now Suite with his wife, Abby Lincoln. Every composition on that record is basically talking about fighting for rights, not only in America, but in places like South Africa. And he was strongly political and very active from the 60s on. And so we felt we wanted to do a film that looked at his whole career, but it's real, his activism. And I happen to have known Max for many years. I began shooting footage with Max in the late 80s. And then I spent time with him in Italy and in San Diego. So I got to know him really well. I'm a great admirer of his. And the Arthur Ashe documentary, Arthur Ashe is the only African-American, the only Black person to ever win Wimbledon in 1975 against Jimmy Connors. And he also was one of the first ones to win the U.S. Open. And he had a very phenomenal career. But it's interesting that he came up during the turbulent 60s, where he was trying to find himself when other Black sports figures were being much more active, people like Jim Brown and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Muhammad Ali. And he was really always sort of struggling to figure out where he stood, you know, in that struggle for activism. And he finally did. He really was very prominent in looking at what was going on with apartheid in South Africa. So, again, two films about two people whose, you know, professional work is phenomenal, but also very active politically and socially.
Well, Sam Pollard, we wish you success with those films and your current film, MLK, FBI. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Documentary filmmaker Sam Pollard, his 1992 film, Going Back to T-Town, which premiered on PBS's American Experience, will be reshown this next Monday, February 8th, on PBS. His most recent film, the feature documentary MLK FBI, is currently in theaters and available on demand. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.